This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, November 21st, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. In a few minutes on the program, excerpts from a conversation recorded at the Fayetteville Public Library last month when Pulitzer Prize winner David Shipler discussed his book, The Working Poor, in front of members of several of the region's book clubs. He was in Fayetteville as part of the annual One Book, One Community project. That's just ahead. KUAF is supported by Urban Jungle Tropical Plant Care and Rental, offering a variety of indoor plants for residential or commercial space and serving Northwest Arkansas with maintenance-free month-to-month care and services. Photos and information available at urbanjunglenwa.com or 466-5033. Support also comes from To Enjoy Magazine, a monthly publication offering local arts, culture, and entertainment. The second annual Crystal Bridges Museum commemorative issue is now available. To Enjoy thanks everyone for their positive response over the past 3 years. Subscriptions and more information are available at 464-8900 or numeral 2enjoymag.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Last month, the One Book, One Community series of events in Fayetteville married town and gown with conversation, discussions, and panels inspired by the book The Working Poor by David Shipler. The Pulitzer Prize-winning writer spent many years at the New York Times, and he spent years researching and interviewing people for the book about individuals, couples, and families living near or below the poverty level. He gave a public lecture on the University of Arkansas campus, and just before his visit to the region ended, he sat down with me at the Fayetteville Public Library for a conversation. Our audience was the annual gathering of the groups, members of several of the area's book clubs. Here are some of the highlights of that conversation.
We have what we call the American Dream, which is a myth. But myths are very useful in societies, and we have quite a few of them in ours. Other countries have them. Our myth is that if you work hard, you will prosper. It's a very powerful myth. It's a wish. Richard Wright called it the truth of the power of the wish. The truth of the power of the wish. And it's important and useful not because it's actually real, but because it sets a very high standard. And the gap between that high standard and the reality is a gap that we yearn to close, I think, most of us. The trouble is that it's only one side of a coin, that the other side is the anti-myth. Because if it's true that everyone who works hard can prosper, then logically it is suggested that if you're not prospering, you're not working hard. And so this myth and anti-myth collide and grate against one another and form the foundations or the framework of what would be loosely called our political debate about poverty, to the extent that we have one, where each end of the spectrum is, I think, trapped in a particular ideological mindset that obscures the more complex reality, which is full of contradictions and ambiguities, as reality always is, which is one of the reasons that I write these books, to challenge my own preconceptions and discover complications. Because it's intellectually rewarding to see that real life doesn't fit neatly into preconceived boxes.
You mentioned complexity. When you read about the people that you visited with, and often, you realize that many of them had so many different obstacles to get out of poverty, to become something beyond the situation they were in. You mentioned Kara King, I think it was, who was in New Hampshire, who became ill, and she had epilepsy, was not supposed to drive, but in order to have a job, she had to, because she lived in rural America where there wasn't public transportation. All these things that stack up to work against somebody.
Yeah, I mean, the problems that families in poverty face are interrelated, and they magnify one another, and they create chain reactions that sometimes are related in surprising ways. I mean, Kara was an example of that, but Another woman in New Hampshire I met, Lisa Brooks, had a slightly different set of issues. She had a full-time job working as an aide in a group home for mentally ill adults. And she made, at that time, $8.21 an hour. She had full health insurance, but every dime that came in went out. She had no savings. And so when she had to move into a drafty wooden house, her son's asthma worsened. There's been a lot of research in the last 20 years on the relationship between housing and children's asthma, asthma being a problem that's exacerbated by certain antigens in houses, such as dust mites and mold and roaches that shed their skin into a fine dust and trigger attacks. And twice her son had to be rushed by ambulance to the hospital. Her insurance company, for reasons she never was able to understand, paid for the emergency room treatment, but not the ambulance. And that cost $240 one time, $250 the next. Lisa couldn't pay either. She had no savings. And so those charges damaged her credit report. And when she needed to get a new car, because her old car died, and she needed it to get to work, she needed a new used car, she went to a reputable car dealer, and the salesman ran a credit check and said, "I'm sorry, I can't make you a car loan." So she ended up at a sleazy used car lot where they didn't run credit checks, but they charged her 15.75% interest on a car loan. Now, this was some years ago when interest rates were higher, but by coincidence, she told me this right around the time I had received an unsolicited offer in the mail for a car loan at half that rate, which demonstrates the fact that people are like businesses when they borrow money. Healthy businesses can float bonds with AAA ratings. These folks are not rated AAA. This morning I was having breakfast with some people from the law school at the university and a couple of legal aid attorneys who were explaining that there are certain sort of credit protection subscriptions that you can sign up for that cost when you buy something at a store like a computer or something like that, and you pay $17 a month or $19 a month to protect your credit, supposedly. And a lot of low-income people do this, but they end up paying huge amounts of money for virtually no protection. So there are lots of scams. There are lots of problems that people get into financially, partly because they're not aware, they're not sophisticated, they may not understand even what interest rate is, because there are some people who do financial education who say, you say, well, you're paying the equivalent of 300% a year interest on this 2-week advance payment on your tax return refund, the H&R Block might charge you for, and that doesn't register because folks don't know what interest is. They don't understand that that's an exorbitant amount. So there's a tremendous amount of exploitation that can occur, and these problems, this chain reaction from one problem to the next is part of what I've come to think of and other people have called the ecology of poverty. It's kind of like an ecological system of relationships among individuals, their families, their neighborhoods, their schools, government services, the private sector, and so forth.
Your book is not a policy book, but very subtly and almost always there is discussion of policy, but that's because it's about people. You spent time with people. This wasn't a hit and run. You didn't go in, talk to someone for an afternoon and leave. How would you find the people that would talk to you and visit with you over a kitchen table, and what were the relationships like?
Well, my sociology professors would not approve of my methodology because it was very unscientific. What I did was go to organizations that were working in the anti-poverty field, whether job training programs, home visiting programs, housing authorities, medical clinics, and so forth. And I would ask, first I asked them if they could recommend some people who would be good to interview, and that didn't work well because the organizations were understandably protective of their clients and didn't want some reporter coming in and being a voyeur. So I changed my initial pitch and I said, "All right, I'm interested in finding out about your programs. What do you do?" And of course they were very happy to talk about those. And I actually was also interested in their programs. It wasn't a lie. It was not my ultimate goal, though. And when people would talk about issues and the problems they were seeing, I'd ask them if they knew anyone who might be willing to talk to me about those particular problems. And they'd say, well, we'll check, and they would. And invariably, people said yes. And then I decided it would be a good idea to follow them for some years, because people's memories play tricks on them. And it's better to observe what's happening than to trust recollections that may be some years old. So I went back to the same people again and again, to the extent possible. I mean, it wasn't always possible. People were not 100% willing to have me intrude on their lives all the time. But, you know, enough were that I was able to get a sense of how their situations developed over time.
How big a role, because many of the people you talked to had jobs, had full-time jobs, or close to full-time jobs, but what role do low wages play in the inability to get out of a bad situation?
Well, you know, that great economist Woody Allen said that poverty is a tragedy, especially from the financial point of view. Money is the centerpiece of the issue. It, you know, the low wages are endemic in service industries and many retail industries. It's not, and by the way, the legal aid lawyers were telling me that there is a terrible, and one of the lawyers at the law school, that there's a terrible problem of companies stealing wages from people, in effect, by just not paying them their wages. So there's a lot of litigation on that and so forth, but you know that compounds the low wage problem. If you look at the statistics, you see that this year a family of four, headed by a single adult, an adult with three children, has to have an income of $22,050 to be at the poverty line. Now, if you work a full-time job, 40 hours a week, and many people can't get that many hours, that comes out, as I recall, to $10.63 an hour, something like that. Think about that. That's a pretty high wage for people working in low-skilled jobs. The federal minimum wage is $7.25. So a single adult working in a low-skilled job, probably with three kids, will probably be below the poverty line. And the poverty line is artificially low because it's based on family spending in the 1950s when the average family spent about a third of its income for food. Now the expenditure is about a sixth or a seventh for food. Housing has become a much bigger cost. So, you know, the income is supplemented by certain government programs. People can get Medicaid, CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, for their kids, food stamps, now called SNAP. Food stamps, by and large, families would tell me, took them into the second or third week of the month, but not beyond, usually. Housing subsidies, but they're inadequate. Section 8 vouchers with which you can rent on the private market. But if you're not public housing, affordable housing, but if you're not getting housing subsidies, and you're working at a low wage, you're really in trouble. I don't know what rents are like around here, but in many parts of the country, low-income families on the market are paying 50 to 70% of their income for rent. And that's not an optional payment. They've got to write that check every month. They've got to make the car payment every month. They've got to pay the electric bill. They've got to pay the cable bill if they want to participate in the American Forum. You know, that's the window into the outside world. And the part of the budget that can be squeezed is for food. So there's a high correlation, one big study found, between low-income families without housing subsidies and underweight children. And as you all probably know, malnutrition, when it occurs during the last two trimesters of pregnancy and or the first 2 years of life, during critical periods of brain development, can have lifelong cognitive effects. So you see these disparate problems, housing to malnutrition. It's very logical and obvious when you lay it out, but by and large, we don't think of it that way. We think of these issues as separate and existing in discrete categories, and that's the way government services are also set up to address the problems in discrete categories.
You mentioned cable television. One of the chapters, you have discussions with people who, some people who had been very poor and not as poor anymore, some people who are poor, and the different opinions about people who have cable television or pets, and how some people think that if you have not much money, you shouldn't have cable television at all. It was a very interesting discussion.
Yes, I found people who had been in poverty who were working with the poor in anti-poverty organizations much more open to criticizing people in poverty for bad decisions and mismanaging their money than middle class folks who were working in these organizations who I guess felt they didn't want to be disdainful. But once the subject was opened up, then there was a chorus of complaints. I think when you know, the people who really know these issues the best are the people at the grassroots level who actually work in agencies that try to help folks. I think they see past the ideological categories. They understand that both the society and individuals have failed and made mistakes. And therefore, whatever solutions we come up with have to address that whole spectrum of you know, areas of responsibility. There is a kind of, attitude that poor people shouldn't have enjoyment. A woman, Anne Brash, I wrote about, who grew up in the middle class and then fell into poverty after a divorce, told me that her relatives were very indignant when she went and bought strawberries, for example. It seemed like an indulgence that she wasn't morally entitled to because she was poor. And I think the same could be said about cable TV or other things like that. There was one couple I wrote about who got their earned income tax credit payment from the IRS. Most people said, I'm going to use it to, people say, when I get my taxes, you know, it's like, when I get my taxes, I do not say that. I don't say when I get my taxes. But when I get my taxes, I'm going to pay my bill, my electric bill. When I get my taxes, I'm going to buy new furniture. This couple, when they got their taxes, they got tattoos. And a friend of mine who's an economist in Washington who is a very strong proponent of the earned income tax credit, when he read the book said, oh, I really wish you hadn't put that in.
But one thing that came through to me in the book is that we all make bad decisions. It's just some people have a smaller margin of error than others.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, you know, I once, after I left the Times, I kept a monthly budget and looked at where my money was going. It was pretty shocking. But I had a cushion, you know, and people who don't have a cushion get into trouble very, very quickly. And sometimes not through their own fault. If a car breaks down and they can't get to work, they could lose their job, and or if it has to go into the shop, or they're child gets sick and they don't have any plan B for daycare and that sort of thing. It just puts them into a downward spiral.
You mentioned how so many things are connected, and one theme that came through is sexual abuse and how that is a huge problem in the United States.
I think it's an epidemic, probably not just in the United States, and I think it probably crosses all socioeconomic lines. I was quite surprised that most of the women I interviewed, when I asked them about their childhood, told me they had been sexually abused by their fathers or their stepfathers or their mother's boyfriends or an older brother in a foster family. And my wife is a social worker, and I said to her, I don't understand why they're telling me this. I didn't ask this question. I'm a stranger. And she said, that's why, because you're a stranger. You're safe. You don't know the families. You're not going to have contact with them. And I think that was true because we were talking, these folks and I, about poverty and about their particular situations. And my question underlying everything was, how did you get here? Why are you here? And for many of these women, that abuse was a factor. Sometimes they would say, I can't have a good relationship with a man. I don't have a sense of trust, because perhaps they would go to their mothers and complain, and the mothers would dismiss it as couldn't be true. I think we know enough about this problem to understand that it's a trauma, and people suffer from PTSD. There are mechanisms, psychological mechanisms that are activated, dissociative reactions where you see it happening to someone else. You may have difficulty being accessible emotionally, which is a defense, but it's the wrong reflex to be a good parent. So if you are poor, if you are affluent and you have access to professional help, you may have a better chance of recovering. And of course, people get through this without professional help as well, and professional help is no guarantee either. But if you're poor, you may not even know that professional help is available for this. You may feel very isolated and alone in it, as if it never happened to anyone else. Although with all the publicity about it now, there may be more awareness that this is a larger, broader problem. And so you don't have the wherewithal to pay for counseling. And if you get counseling, it's on a pro bono basis. It'll be a few sessions, and then you'll have to move on to someone else. So I think that the problem is perhaps more severe for those of low income, not because the incidence is necessarily higher, but because the ability to get out of that past trauma may be more difficult.
It's a recurring theme in the book.
Yeah.
Just limited access. I'm going to ask if there are any questions here in a moment. The two words that come up a lot in the book, invisible and hidden. This is a big problem in this country. There are many people who are suffering, yet we don't talk about it much, and many of the people who fall under that title, working poor, do remain, at least metaphorically, hidden or invisible.
Well, that's why I'm so glad that the university has made this book a vehicle for a broader discussion, not just on campus, but in the community, and that you have all participated in this, and that we're here talking about it, because it is a problem that's not discussed at the political level, and the press isn't very good at covering it either. And there are reasons for that we could go into, but I think that part of the reason it's hidden is that American myth that if you're working hard, you're not poor. I mean, it just seems like an oxymoron. And people, I keep thinking of the phrase from Edgar Allan Poe, hidden in plain sight. And people who are working poor are hidden in plain sight. We do encounter them all the time. We go to the store, see them stocking shelves, checking us out, as cashiers. The fruits of their labor are in our lives. When we sit down for Thanksgiving dinner in a few weeks, the sweet potatoes that we eat will have been harvested probably by the working poor. The Christmas trees that we put in our houses will have been cut by the working poor. These are folks who are often migrant workers in terms of agriculture, but are paid often on a piecework basis or a very low wage. And I think that they wear their jobs like camouflage. Because in America, if you have a job, you're not supposed to be poor. So you blend in. You're invisible partly because of our ideology, the truth of the power of the wish.
David Shipler is the author of the book, The Working Poor. He visited Fayetteville and the University of Arkansas last month as the guest of the annual One Book, One Community event. Our conversation was recorded in front of an audience at the Fayetteville Public Library. There is more to the discussion in just a moment. Excerpts from the question and answer portion of that afternoon. That's just ahead on Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. On this Thanksgiving Eve edition of our program, we're listening to portions of a conversation I had with David Shipler, author of the book The Working Poor, recorded in front of an audience at the Fayetteville Public Library last month. Several members of the audience asked him questions, including one about the value of helping those struggling near or below the poverty level, a value David Shipler says extends beyond those families immediately helped.
I think you're right about that, because I'll give you an example of how I think that plays out. I talked about housing and malnutrition and the effect on brain development. There've been some interesting longitudinal studies. It's going to take me a little while to get to your argument. I hope you'll bear with me. There've been some longitudinal studies of infants who suffered from iron deficiency during those critical periods of brain development. They went back to these kids, and then their nutrition was restored. They went back to these kids as adolescents and tested them. And they found, in fact, I may have, if I have this, sorry about that. If I have these results, I'll read them to you so that I don't get them wrong. And here they are. So they found that even after their nutrition was restored, these children who had suffered from iron deficiency during infancy scored lower in math, writing, motor functioning, spatial memory, and selective recall. They exhibited more anxiety, depression, social problems, and attention problems. So they didn't. Their mental abilities didn't recover. Now, if you have cognitive difficulties, I would guess, and I do not have any studies to cite, but I would guess logically that you have a higher probability of dropping out of school. I mean, my wife said to me when I was doing this, she used to be an elementary school teacher, ask kids when you go to schools what percentage of the time they don't understand what the teacher is saying. So I did, and I got some startling answers. 40% of the time, 50%, 60%. So I would say, well, what do you do about that? Well, Mrs. Black is okay. You know, she'll give us, you know, she'll explain things. But Mr. Gray just gets mad at us for not paying attention. Now, I think if you have to sit for hours a day not understanding half of what goes on in a class, you're probably not going to stay there if you can get out of it. And when people drop out of high school, the most recent figures I've seen, show that they earn an average of $26,000 less a year, pay $60,000 less in taxes over their lifetimes, and have health conditions at age 45 equivalent to the health of an average 65-year-old high school graduate. If you look at the U.S. Department of Education's National Assessment of Adult Literacy, which is done every 10 years, in which a large sample of adults is given little tasks to do, the results are really scary, and I have these too, which I'll give to you. The last time it was done was 2003, so we're coming up to another time. And what it showed that was that 55% could not look at a catalog of office supplies, pick out certain items to order, and add up the total cost. 55%. 55% could not read the label on a bottle of prescription medicine and understand when to take the medicine in relation to meals. 55%. 43% could not read a job wanted ad and summarize the work experience that was required for the job. 43%. 34% could not follow directions on a map. Now, with GPS, we're going to all lose that skill, I suppose. But still, I mean, it's. And 22%, being told an hourly wage, could not add it up to come to the total of a weekly wage. Now, if this is accurate, and I have no, I mean, and by the way, it's given in Spanish as well, and the non-Spanish, non-English speakers who were surveyed were such a tiny fraction of the sample that the difference, you know, by on the basis of language was probably insignificant. Now, if this is accurate, It means that the labor force in the United States is not competitive in a global marketplace, which is ruthless. Business leaders, business owners say they can't find skilled workers. I wrote about one fellow in Cleveland who's the third generation of a family that owns a manufacturing company that makes hydraulic hoses, and he wanted to expand. This was some years ago, and couldn't. After the book came out, I met in Baltimore the owner of a trucking company who said he needed more diesel mechanics and truck drivers and couldn't find them. I said, "Will you train them?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "What do you pay?" He said, $21-$22 an hour." Now, Baltimore has a high unemployment rate, so there's probably a problem there of just sort of connecting the business needs with the unemployed, but there also may be a problem, and I'll bet there is, among many unemployed in Baltimore of low skills, reading problems, math problems, which you do, you need those skills certainly to be a diesel mechanic. And it's not so easy to get a truck driving license. You got to take tests and stuff. So I think that you're absolutely right when you suggest that helping address the problems of poverty is not just pure altruism. There's a self-interested part of that, very much so.
Young woman here had not finished the book yet, so she was wondering if there were any solutions at the end or if there was going to be another book.
I wrote the book and I didn't have, there is a final chapter with some broad ideas for addressing the problems. When I wrote the book, I didn't have that last chapter in it at first. I felt it needed, I'm a reporter basically, I'm not a policy wonk, I'm not an economist, I'm not really well versed in the way the financial private sector works. And so I was hesitant to wade into the prescription writing process. So I sent the manuscript to my editor at Knopf, and I don't usually do this. I usually wait till I'm really done and it's really in as good a condition as I think I can get it, and then I send it to him. But this time I sent it to him, and I said, what do you think? Do I need a last chapter on solutions? Because I kind of think I do, but it gets me into territory I'm not 100% comfortable with, to be honest. And he said, yeah, it does need it. It begs for that. So the last chapter does have some broad ideas about. I mean, my basic argument that I make that probably hasn't been made, very widely. I mean, a lot of the solutions, so-called solutions, or possible ways of alleviating the problem are pretty obvious. Higher earned income tax credit payments, more food stamp coverage, broader Medicaid, which of course the Affordable Care Act will provide if the states agree to accept it. More housing subsidies and that sort of thing, higher minimum wage perhaps. But beyond that, I think we need gateways through which poor families can pass into multiple services. So that, for example, there's a food bank in Washington, D.C. called Bread for the City. And when someone comes in to get food, the person goes through an intake and is asked lots of questions about medical care, about whether they're actually signed up for Medicaid if they're eligible, whether they're having a housing issue, and so forth. For a lot of time, I don't know right now whether they have a lawyer there, but they often have had an attorney right there in that food bank office, paid for by a separate grant, who can help people with housing problems. And the pediatrics department at the Boston Medical Center discovered that to deal with asthma, children's asthma, they had to hire lawyers to call the landlords. Pediatricians calling the landlords didn't do any good. So they now have five lawyers at the pediatrics department of the Boston Medical Center. And there are almost 200 medical legal partnerships around the country that have followed this model, because doctors are understanding that environmental problems can exacerbate disease. So they have the food bank has a medical clinic next door. So there's a whole way of seeing the interaction. If you see the interactions among the problems, then the solutions kind of follow naturally. if you can find the services and guide people to them so that they can, when they come presenting one problem, they get some action on a range of problems. And that's very expensive. And that costs a lot of money. I mean, schools could be our ideal gateways. I mean, teachers see kids coming in from, you know, with terrible problems, but there's not a lot the teachers can do in most school systems. Police departments. I just heard that the sheriff's department here has a person assigned to try to get recovering addicts who've been through rehab, through the drug court, jobs. So there's kind of a job placement person in the sheriff's department. That's a very smart idea. That kind of combining of, you know, taking people who come to a particular place and providing something beyond what that place is designed to give is the, I think, a very important approach.
Yes, ma'am. The comment was she hopes that we can figure some things out, but she's concerned that the poor will always be with us, remembering Lyndon Baines Johnson's war on poverty.
Yeah, which we lost, I guess, right?
We lose everything that we call domestically a war.
I think that's a fair comment. That is, you know, I think it's not realistic to imagine that there will never, ever be any people in poverty, no matter how assiduously we apply our knowledge and skills to the problem and our resources, because it costs money. There are people who are have mental problems, mentally ill, who have substance abuse problems, who are physically disabled, and you know, for lots of other situations, which really prevent them from seeing their skills rise to the level in which they can get work that will pay adequately. I do think, though, that between that group and the poverty level now, which is 15.2%, there's a lot of possibility. And I can't give you statistics to prove it, but just in my experience of spending time with families, people who are very hardworking, but who thought of themselves as lazy, by the way. I mean, there's a syndrome of internalizing the judgments of the majority. This happens in among racial minorities as well. I did a book on race relations and found lots of African Americans regarding themselves as less because they've heard it so much from the white majority. And this happens, I think, with people in poverty. I remember Deborah Hall in Cleveland, a woman who got up at 2 or 3 in the morning to work in a bakery on an assembly line and a mind-numbing job. When I asked her why she was poor, she said, lazy, I'm lazy. I said, you're lazy, you work harder than I do. But that's the way she perceived of herself. And that's a debilitating self-assessment because it saps you of the belief in yourself. And that belief is really essential to moving out of poverty. If you don't believe in yourself, you're not going to do your work well, you're not going to engage people in a confident manner, you're not going to get the education or the job training that you need. So all of that is part of the problem. But I do believe that the so-called safety net, which we hear about, is really tattered. It's really tattered. And that could be strengthened, and the levels of assistance could be raised so that fewer and fewer people are in poverty. You know, if you want to look at some statistical discussion of this, go on the Census Bureau website, census.gov, and find the section on what they call the supplemental poverty measure. You know, I told you that the way the poverty line is calculated is outmoded. For some years, they've been experimenting with more sophisticated methods, and they now have come up with a way of doing it. It's not the official poverty line, though. It has no impact on eligibility. So it's only for, you know, it's the sake of curiosity. But when they do that, first of all, the poverty rate goes up to 16%, because they put housing as a big component of it. And they also count as income government benefits, which are not counted in the official poverty rate. So the result of that, though, is it's very interesting. They go into government programs and they do a little calculation of what would happen to the poverty rate if those programs did not exist. So then I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they take away food stamps and you see the poverty rate going up. They take away housing subsidies, you see the poverty rate going up. That kind of thing. And that tells you something about the impact of government programs and therefore the impact on increasing the scope of such programs to help people. So, but what I'm trying to argue in the book and when I speak to people is that lots of problems have to be addressed simultaneously. You can't just do one thing and expect that to carry over into addressing other issues. People need training in many respects. The best job training programs don't train people only in hard skills. They also train them in what they call soft skills. I've spent time at a job training program in DC run by a Catholic organization, So Others Might Eat, where some of the people coming in at the beginning could not have a conversation. They were so beaten down. You know, if you failed at school and you failed in relationships and you failed in job after job, you know, you don't suddenly believe you can succeed. And they would look at the floor and mumble. And one of the classes was in office skills, learning computer techniques. It was run by a retired Marine Corps sergeant who showed them a lot of tough love. And he told me, I've structured it so everyone has at least one success every day. And he'd make them stand up in front of the trainees periodically and give little talks, extemporaneous or prepared. And he'd say, look at me, I can't hear you. And by the end of several months, the eyes came up off the floor, the voices gained clarity. People began to actually believe in themselves. And the Xerox Corporation, which does a lot of, they run mail rooms and copying rooms in Washington for lobbyists and law firms, hired a lot of people out of this program. And the human resources director said to me, I don't hire off the street anymore. I hire from that program because they deal with the whole person. They teach anger management. They teach punctuality. They teach work ethics. These are all very important. I talked to a lot of business people who said to me, you know, they complained, people don't show up at work. They don't call in if they're sick or they can't come. One of them was a guy I know who used to run Burger Kings. He would open one after another franchise for a larger owner. And it took him 6 months every time to get a core of workers who were dependable. So I mentioned this to Anne Brash, the woman who grew up in the middle class and fell into poverty, who had a very nice set of insights about poverty. She was quite perceptive. I said, you know, they say people aren't showing up. People aren't calling in if they're sick. She said, maybe they don't think they're important enough for anybody to care if they come to work. And I took this back to the Burger King manager, and it was like a light bulb going on over his head. He said, oh. He said, yeah, absolutely right. The fellow I mentioned in Cleveland who owns this small manufacturing company told me about a guy who didn't show up one day, and he called him up, and what happened, his car broke down. So the boss sent a worker to go pick him up and bring him in because he wanted him to understand that he was important. He was on the payroll because he needed him, and if he didn't come, he'd miss a production deadline or have to move people off that job to another. And so this whole, what one student who read the book and did a paper on it called The Internal Problems of the Poor, which I'd thought of, wish I had thought of that, but she thought of it. The internal problems of the poor need to be addressed as well. And they can be. And there are successes. And people do move up and out. Not many, but it does happen, which gives you hope that it can happen.
Finally, when those of us in this room finish working poor and we set it down on our coffee table, whatever, what do you want us to take away?
I'd like you to take away a non-ideological view of the problem, recognizing that real people don't fit neatly into either the box that the liberal Democrats create or the box that conservative Republicans create, but actually mix various factors. That the society as a whole has an interest, a self-interest, and also, I think, a moral commitment to find a way to make this ingenious private enterprise system that we have work better for everyone. It is ingenious. You know, I paraphrased, or I took Winston Churchill's line. You know, he made this famous statement, democracy is the worst system, except for all of the others that have been tried from time to time. And I plugged different words in, and I said, capitalism is the worst system, except for all of the others that have been tried from time to time. I lived for 4 years in a socialist country, the Soviet Union, so I've seen firsthand the terrible effects of that system. So I'm a big believer in the private market, but it needs to be tweaked, it needs to be managed, it needs to be regulated, and as a community, we do have, excuse me, the resources to do that and the mechanisms. I mean, I'm distressed at the anti-government attitudes. I was just in Waco, Texas last week and was told that there was a summer feeding program for kids that was started by two women who raised private funds because kids weren't in school because they weren't getting the free lunch there. And they refused to take government money, even though the U.S. Department of Agriculture has money for exactly for that program. But we don't want government money. And I guess my feeling was, well, you're sending money to Washington. You might as well get some back, you know. But this sort of gut reaction against government, I think misses a feature of government that in America is very important, because we are an open society and we are a democracy, and the government is created by us, and therefore it can be a mechanism through which we, the citizens, mobilize our financial resources to do common good. I'm also aware that of all the pitfalls of that, and certainly having just written two books on civil liberties issues, I'm extremely sensitive to providing too much power to government. But I think that thinking creatively about the role, the interactions between government and the private sector, and about the non-ideological nature of poverty and the non-ideological approaches to poverty would be important things to take away.
David Shipler, thank you very much.
Thanks.
David Shipler spoke at the Fayetteville Public Library last month as the final event in the 2012 edition of One Book, One Community in Fayetteville and on the University of Arkansas campus. Our discussion was in front of the annual gathering of the groups, a collection of many members of several book clubs in the region. This is Ozarks at Large.
The Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 21st of November, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who helped spark the Enlightenment in France. He wrote under the name Voltaire. He was born in Paris, 1694, as François-Marie Arouet. Voltaire wrote so much in his lifetime, his collected works are still being assembled and edited. But we know him for his single short novel, Candide, about a young man who follows the philosophy of Dr. Pangloss that no matter what misfortunes befall us, this is the best of all possible worlds. He grew up at a time when Louis XIV was persecuting Protestants. There was little freedom of speech or religion in France. Voltaire was one of the first writers to challenge the restrictions, was sent into exile, thrown into prison in the Bastille. He was there for 11 months, and his imprisonment only made him famous. And when he got out of prison, he started using the name Voltaire. Voltaire, who said, "Let us read and let us dance, two amusements that will never do any harm to the world." It's the birthday of jazz saxophonist Coleman Hawkins, born St. Joseph, Missouri, 1904, whose recording of Body and Soul was considered one of the great improvisations in the history of jazz. It's the birthday of Marilyn French, Brooklyn, New York, 1929, wrote her first book on James Joyce, and then switched her focus to women's history and feminism. She was a college English professor. She was nearly 50 years old when she published her novel, The Women's Room, a book that sold more than 20 million copies, considered one of the most influential novels of the second wave feminist movement. And many years later, published a four-volume work on women's history, From Eve to Dawn. It was on this day in 1877, Thomas Edison announced that he'd invented a new device called the phonograph for recording and playing back sound. He recorded himself reciting the poem Mary Had a Little Lamb and played it for people, and people who saw the first demonstrations of the phonograph found it rather spooky and ghostly. People were uneasy about the phonograph. Bram Stoker included the phonograph as a plot device in his novel Dracula. And to make people feel more comfortable with the idea of playing back sound, the Columbia Phonograph Company commissioned John Philip Sousa's U.S. Marine Band to record marches, patriotic music, and they became the first successful musical recordings to be sold. Here's a poem for today by Ursula K. Le Guin, Every Land, with an epigram from Black Elk, The Holy Land is Everywhere. Watch where the branches of the willows bend, see where the waters of the rivers tend, graves in the rock, cradles in the sand, every land is the Holy Land. Here was the battle to the bitter end, here's where the enemy killed the friend, blood on the rock, tears on the sand. Every land is the Holy Land. Willow by the water, bending in the wind, bent till it's broken and it cannot stand. Listen to the word the messengers send, life from the living rock, death in the sand. Every land is the Holy Land. Ursula K. Le Guin's poem, Every Land, from her collection, Finding My Elegy, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering stories that go beyond business and finance to something new. Subscriptions at subscribe.wsj.com/getweekend. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Jasper. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Tomorrow, Christina Thomas will join me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy studio for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. You can learn more about our show and hear past editions at ozarksatlarge.com. Have a pleasant day before Thanksgiving. Thanks so much for listening.